We begin the hour by welcoming in friend of the program, writer Colin Fleming. His newest book is Meatheads Say the Realest Things. It's available everywhere. Get it. Be a better person. Hello, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
I'm doing all right. How's your phone? Is that working out?
Yes, we found a solution today. And
excellent.
You're actually the first person I've spoken to on the phone. So I was kind of curious how it's going to work. And I used a new ringtone. So when it rang just now, I actually frightened myself with some scary sci-fi music. I thought, oh, is this how it ends? Is this, I had a heart attack? Is this like my outro music? I'm like, no, it's your phone, Kimball. Go time, baby.
Your own death scored by Bernard Herrmann.
Yeah, something with a theremin in it, maybe.
Ooh.
Me going out that way. And you know what I always say, Kimball? At least it will be over.
I know this from having seen the picture. And nobody in this man's world that can make a downtown shirt look good when it's soaked in sweat like Colin Fleming.
I turned, and I knew you'd appreciate that.
Yes.
Because, of course, you're well-versed in the original color of that shirt. And that's why I think I added to you that I even went through a T-shirt first underneath it. But doing those government center stairs, I've really modified my workout now. So it's just going to government center. I'm not walking that much. I'm just running these stairs. And I have people say many more nice things to me about my stairs than they ever have about anything else in my life, which is quite depressing. But if you were really into stairs, I guess it would be like pretty heartening.
All right, much to talk about this afternoon. Let's begin with this idea. You've talked about it on the Many Moments More blog, the notion that we're living in a post-reality world. What does that mean?
Did you enjoy? And you too, downtownians, can go to the blog and enjoy this yourself. Not just a post about this subject, but you can enjoy this fine young woman that we're about to discuss. Did you enjoy the exchange with that woman who told me that, what she said, just to get some background out there, my forays into love, my aborted forays. She said, look at you with your big boy words. So right away, guy like you, Kimball, you know that I hate someone like that. I don't like, these are big boy words. These are like small table words. These are like in between words. No, words are just ways you communicate, and it's more the arrangement of the words, the individual words themselves for efficacious communication. And she said, she bragged about herself and said, I'm this kind of combo, but you don't like acronyms, stipulated very firmly. She said, you don't like acronyms, so I should say combination. Now, I'm in a bad position, am I not, Kimball? Do you want to insult this person? Like, do I just like, whatever, it's fine. And I don't like her anyway, but I just say, thanks, but that's not what the word acronym means. And I've even put up my dating profile on the blog, so someone can look at it, and it's written like you'd expect me to write it. You could be like, oh, wow, that's a story for the ages. It's not like, hey, I can stay in or go out, don't sweat the small stuff, life's too short, and get the two wrong. I don't do that. So she then has back at me, and it's like, what are you supposed to do? She says, you should look up the word and find out what it means.
Yeah, after she says, wow, this is why you're single.
Yes, yes, and the reason let's be honest, the reason I'm single is I'm just on a different plane, and that's really a problem, and it's not me being obnoxious, it's just the reality of the situation that I have to contend with until I find someone brilliant, dynamic, and historic, and I haven't met her yet, and kind, and good, and character-laden, but that hasn't worked out to date. Probably end up breaking through, making a lot of money, being incredibly famous, and then meet someone that way and have to wonder if she ever actually really loved me, but that's fine. It's the bridge to cross when I get to it. But yeah, so what was I supposed to do? And I said something just real. It's like saying the ocean is wet. No, it's not. Like, people just want to infuse their own version of reality as something that supersedes reality. Now, I know why she didn't understand what the word acronym meant, because she looked up the definition, and then the definition said takes the initial letter of a succession of words. And you didn't know the word initial, because people don't know that. But this is how it works now. You can say whatever you want, however erroneous. Another blog entry calls it the ass voice. You employ the ass voice, and what you want to avoid happening is have someone who No, it's because really, if you think about it, it would have been insulting and objectifying and treating her like she was a moron who wasn't worthy of like any reality if I said, oh, yeah, no, that's great. Really fine understanding you have there of acronym. It's like bring your own beer. Like you take the first letters. So I see this all the time now. And people hate, well, certainly they hate anyone who knows. And
right.
They especially hate experts. It's like the kids have run amok. And someone walks into the room and says, like, no, it's not actually like that. I've read a book. You can also read a book. And they think, you suck. I hate you. Go away, fun wrecker.
What I find challenging is I don't want to correct people all the time. And so my criteria tends to be, how arrogant are they in their post? Are they spouting some level of not accurate expertise? And then if they've gone there, if they've crossed that bridge, then I'm happy to pile on and say, you used the word wrong. You spelled it wrong. Actually, I don't usually jump on spellings because I know you're going fast on a keyboard. That can be a simple typographical error. But when you use a word incorrectly, yeah, if you've shown your horse's ass already, I'll kick you.
I think the context matters too, because in this particular case, it's ostensibly people trying to see if they're a connection or not. So I'm not someone, and you can imagine how much of this I could do. I mean, obviously, who could just go around and be the scold, correcting every... I don't see a single sentence that's correct. I don't see... look at the subjects I'm an expert on. I never hear anyone. I don't hear the so-called experts say anything correctly. They're just talking out of their ass, too. And nobody knows. So who's going to sort of apply a system of checks and balance? That's what people want. That's how you build a platform right now. Because then other people just want to look at other people who also use the ass voice. And they want to see their own version of themselves. I mean, why do you think people like Skip Bayless? He's a moron. This is brand. People are morons. They think, he's not smarter than I am. A friend of mine put it this way. You go into a bar and like you're out with your hot girlfriend. And there's a guy playing acoustic guitar in the corner. You want him just to be some hipster who sucks. You don't want him to be like circa 1962, I'm about to break through Bob Dylan, because you want to say to your girlfriend, like, yeah, I can do that. Like, I'll play you something when we get back afterwards. That's what people want. That's why comedians aren't funny. This is the basis now of popular success. It's the basis of critical acclaim. So this woman, she was very self-aggrandizing. She's complimenting herself. And also, you just kind of want to see, like, how well someone takes, like, a joke. You could tell from my tone, there was resignation that I had to say that she was going on about how smart she was. And so she immediately then became hostile. She became vituperative when I pointed out this very simple truth. And then it's just like, for me, it's insult on top of injury, which is like, you don't know what that I mean, imagine saying to me, like, you don't know what a word means. Can you even, like, imagine? Like, you read something I've written. Like, this is the guy. And a friend of mine is like, then you Tyson these people. They say their thing to you, and they don't, like, they're not prepared for what you're going to come back with. It's like you chuck them through four buildings, and they're not ready for that. So then, like, they stalk you, and they round up the mob. And it's like, I just said something true after someone asserted their own, and like, don't tell me you're smart. I'll know it.
Right.
Be it.
But that's social media, which gives everybody a platform, worthy or not, and you can be an expert if you simply declare yourself to be so.
Yes. Well, Kimbo, like, what was it that things blend together? But, like, recently I did that op-ed in the New York Daily News on, I don't even remember what it was on. There's just so many of them. And someone, the New York Daily News, put that up on Twitter, and I made the mistake of looking at the comments. Like, what qualifies you as an expert? Like, one person's like, you only have 150 followers. I have 150 followers because I'm beyond all these people. Because I'm not someone you can look at and be like, oh, he's like me. We're the same level of intelligence. That's why, like, it's I am not someone, like, when you look in this particular mirror, you're going to, that's why we get along. That's why the people, they're secure in themselves. They know things, they're eclectic, they're secure in themselves. If you look at my Twitter followers, even as I'm like this very accessible entertainer and artist, the people are literally rocket scientists who speak like medieval languages. All of them. Like, if you go through it, you will not see one average type of person in there. And that's something I need to remedy, because it's not going to work just getting rocket scientists and judges and people who, like, write books of poetry and read about the Civil War. You can't make enough hay to get anywhere that way. So it's problematic for me. But, yeah, everyone just announces themselves, and then they find out, like, oh, okay, well, you write on the Beatles. You can't possibly be a hockey expert. It's like, sorry. Sorry, I'm unique. There's nothing that's been like this person. And then the more they find out, like, crap, this guy's the jazz guy, he's the fiction guy, and like, then they get angry, and I have to deal with that kind of hostility. So my virtues end up imprisoning me. And so this was just a small kind of microcosmic example of that with this woman.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Speaking of hockey, you have weighed in your thoughts on the decision by David Krejci to head back to the Czech Republic, and you say good, at times very good, but not one of the greatest players of all time, not even one of the greatest in Bruins history.
No, this is along the same lines. I conducted a Twitter experiment the other night because I saw all of these hyperbolic, and people don't think they're being hyperbolic. They're not just caught up in the emotion. They think they know. They're saying, one person wrote that he was not only the most underrated Bruin of all time, the most underrated Boston sports athlete of all time, which is insane. David Krejci, for instance, never had more than 23 goals in a season. He never had more than 73 points. He never averaged a point per game. For the postseason All-Star, which is huge in determining where your career stacks up, that's why Brad Marchand is definitely going to the Hall of Fame, one of the reasons why, and why I know he is, because there's no one who's achieved like he has with postseason All-Star berths. That's to an account like John LeClair, who's failed to make the Hall of Fame. And Krejci has never finished higher than eighth in the voting for centers. And that was a while ago. So really, his career is as a plus player, a solid second-line center, one of the top, I don't know, 30% of the players in the league, who happened, this is sort of his notoriety, to lead the postseason in scoring in two different seasons. And I don't know if anyone's done that and not made the Hall of Fame. But Krejci, and then someone else said, well, think of if he wasn't playing behind one of the all-time greats, like he's not getting the same amount of minutes. It's like people just say things. You get the same amount of ice time as a second-line center as you do as a first-line center. You can get more if you are on the power play or if you're shorthanded, but even strength, you get about the same amount of minutes. It's the guys in the third and fourth line who don't. And for a long time, Krejci was nominally the first-line center of that team. When they won the Cup, he was the first-line center. Bergeron was the second-line center. It doesn't really mean anything. It just means, okay, we're balancing out the line. You can be the best player on the team, and you can be the second-line left wing. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't mean, like, you're the best because you take that face-off and that first shift for 24 seconds. And oftentimes, they'll start the fourth line for energy. And Bergeron himself has never had an 80-point season. I mean, Bergeron's getting into the Hall of Fame based on his Selke wins nomination.
Right.
He's good, and he deserves it, but he's overrated. But this whole Krejci thing, and then think of him playing 5 years with Taylor Hall. Well, neither of them can score. They're both playmakers. Krejci's getting up there in age. He was always slow. He's slower now. So it wasn't like he was all of a sudden going to become late career Johnny Busick and pot 100 points.
All right, let's move from hockey to talking about one of my favorite movies of all time, 1959's Anatomy of a Murder, directed by Otto Preminger, a score from Duke Ellington, a brilliant cast with Jimmy Stewart, Lee Remick, the always great Ben Gazzara, George C. Scott, Arthur O'Connell. I love this movie, but you're going to tell me there are some holes in it.
Was that like a weird panty-based pun, Kimball?
Yes.
Is that what you're
yes.
Doing
oh,
now?
I like that. That you picked up on that. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's a pretty divided film. I think Jimmy Stewart is excellent in it. I think Jimmy Stewart's team is excellent. I think his alcoholic but temporarily reformed mentor lawyer is very good. I think his secretary and sort of matronly figure is excellent. I think the judge, who wasn't even really an actor, he's just in this film.
Yeah, the legendary Joseph Welch, who was the Army counsel in the Army McCarthy hearings.
He's so good. And in fact, you could see him too in being something in like Miracle on 34th Street. I think all of those people are good. I think the prosecution is good, both of those lawyers. It's the narrative that doesn't really work for me, where he just gets off in the end. It's like, okay, I had a moment of temporary insanity. And it doesn't really seem like they make much of a case rhetorically or legally. Like, you know he's going to get off. You know the entire 2.5-hour film is going to get off. But this army guy has this other guy ostensibly, I guess, technically, rape his wife. And that's kind of up in the air, and I guess it becomes sort of a Me Too thing, and who do you believe? And, like, Lee Remick isn't really into selling it that much, and then she kind of is, so, like, her commitment wavers, which is part of her character, and I get that. But it's not like some brilliant, persuasive argument for why he then goes out and kills this guy, the rapist, and it's like, he just gets off. And Jimmy Stewart's so confident, too, that he's going to get off, too, and I don't understand that, because I feel like I could go out and do something horrific, and I'd be like, I had 5 minutes of insanity. I'm pretty sure that's not going to work.
And it's that strange, and I agree with you on that, it is a strange courtroom drama where most of the action really doesn't take place in court. It's the search for evidence. It's the character development that's far more important than any great discovery in the courtroom. There's no big Perry Mason aha moment.
Right. There's not the aha moment, but there's also not the logical progression. So it's a film that doesn't work in the reality of its plot details. Where it works is a character study. And you get into the mindset of the bachelor character, the Jimmy Stewart. I really like the beginning how it's set up. He drives home. He's kind of been blowing off his law practice in, like, this small town, like Mayberry type of town, except, like, in Michigan. And I like that he has this passion for fishing. He comes home, and he wants to relax and have a beer, and, like, his buddy comes by, and, like, small town, rural. It's homey. I relate to that. I connect with that. And I think that's where you get a lot of the appeal of the film, not just in that sequence, but it's threaded with sequences like that. But it's light on the logic. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Even when they find, like, this precedent, the precedent doesn't mean, in other words, what the writer of the film either thinks it means or wants it to mean, or maybe just goes, it's close enough. And when you do that, I find that I look at things differently now than I would have when I was 20. I just have a much different kind of critical lens. Part of it is because I'm just so ruthless in my own work. So that is, if you're going to invest like the 2 hours and 40 minutes in the film, to me, you have to get those details right.
Yeah, I still love it because I love the acting. I love the performances.
And it's very much an actor-driven movie, is what I guess what I'm saying, rather than like a sort of cumulative effect. It's the character study. It's the actors. It's a word-based movie. It's the cadences of Jimmy Stewart's voice. It's the repartee. It's the rapprochement between defense and prosecution and the judge kind of refereeing that makes it work, that makes all of this meld together. Mm. But if you're actually just looking, you'd be like, wait, what? Right. So, like, you can do some murder and, like, I don't know. Just say you're crazy for a bit.
I agree with you on that. From there, let's talk about, I think, unjustly overlooked album by the Rolling Stones. Now, the American version of this album had a couple of hit singles on it. I think they slipped Ruby Tuesday and Let's Spend the Night Together on it, but they were not on the British version of 1967's Between the Buttons.
The bastardization that you got it for a long time, too, with the Beatles. It stopped by 1967 with the Beatles. We get these American versions that aren't really the same at all as the English versions. But I think Between the Buttons is a remarkable album, and there's nothing like it from Stone, certainly. And there's nothing like it in the 1960s from anybody else. It's a complete departure of an album. It's a very urbane, sophisticated album. I liken it to their Rubber Soul, but Rubber Soul was a pastoral album by way of Black rhythm and blues, which is a strange mashup. And this is certainly not a pastoral album. This is like a sophisticated young man in swinging London going to art galleries and experimenting with LSD and the person he's going to bed that night and the Camus novel he's going to read. I feel like that kind of person, collective of those sorts of people, are the drivers behind this album that doesn't, like I said, sound like anything else the Stones ever waxed. And you have like the concluding, for instance, "Something Happened to Me Yesterday," which is obviously about LSD, but it's just such a witty song. And I guess it's a very English song too. I don't know how well it would necessarily translate to, oh, I don't know, the American meathead, like the bit at the end, "If You're on Your Bike Tonight, Wear White," which is just like sort of a sign off that we would have gotten on the news when people like Jagger and Richards were growing up. But it's a unique album. I don't know of anything of a piece with it.
The cut right before that, "Miss Amanda Jones,"
yeah,
that's got one of the great Keith Richards guitar riffs of all time.
It does, and I was going to bring that up too, so you got to it first. And that song is just, I've always thought that. I thought that when I was 15. I thought, wow, this is just so, it's over loud, it's distorted, it's just like crazy, like fuzz box type of thing, and it has this organ quality to it as well. And I've never encountered any discussion. I've never read anything about that song where people have talked about that. It's such a corking number. I mean, what is that even? It's not rhythm and blues. It's not heavy metal. It's like this. The Stones sometimes would get into these pockets of sound where they would make recordings unlike anything that they'd ever make again or anyone else had ever made. They did this in 1966 with 19th Nervous Breakdown, "Have You Seen Your Mother, Baby," "Standing in the Shadows," like a clutch of records like that that they'd never revisit again. And there was no precedent for them. There's certainly no precedent for this album. There's no precedent for that song. And it was just so witty and whip smart and of the world in a way. The Beatles kind of existed in this time out of time when they were on their best records even. They don't really put you in a given era or the day of a certain like flipping of the zeitgeist. The Stones, they did that. And they did that with this album. Like, you feel like you're in Blow Up by Antonioni. I'm like, this is going to play in the background. Like, it very much puts you in the picture, but it doesn't age. It doesn't just stay there. So remarkably fresh. I think part of that is the instrumentation. Brian Jones is like, I'm not really into the guitar anymore. And he started playing all of these different, that's him on tuba on that last cut. So it had just such an exotic but also urbane flavor to it.
And one of the better vocals you'll ever hear from the Stones, and a very different type of vocal than you usually hear on side one's "She Smiled Sweetly."
Different in that it wasn't misogynistic, because sometimes, I guess the vocal's a little bit like Lady Jane from Aftermath. Mm-hmm. It's kind of in like that Jagger doing his impersonation of like a choir boy singing at King's Chapel, which we can thread through with our Mr. M.R. James. But it's him doing an imitation, like the choir boy who skulks off to have the cigarette, you know what I mean? And like look at the dirty magazine and then comes back for Vespers. That's what he's doing, I feel, on a song like "She Smiled Sweetly" and "Lady Jane" before that. But he could sing. I'm going to send you this audience recording. It's super rare. It's from 1965. It's from Germany, and it's really his vocal front and center on this hard to locate bootleg. And you can tell that he's off key. He's not. I mean, it still works, but it's quite a contrast. If you just heard it, you'd think it was just some guy like who can't sing. You'd be like, I can do that. I could front that band.
We also, you mentioned M.R. James. We talked about his story that is a wonderful ghost story. And I knew there were a couple other film versions of it. I had not seen this amateur version from, I think it was 1957. That is just a remarkable piece of cinema.
It is. It's amateur, like you said. It was, how is this for Quint? I love things like this. I wish there were still things like this. It was a movie club. Like, hey, we like movies. Let's get together and talk about them. Want to try and shoot one? just like that. I like things. Get some beer and go out with your friends and try and do like a low budget 10 minute horror film. And so it was actually quite hard for me to track this down. It's up on the BFI's website, but you can't access the video in this country. So I found this alternate source, really, for this film and what the story is about. And I guess if people haven't read this, you should check it out, because it's one of the two or three, four sort of like go-to all-time UR text ghost stories. Like, you have to read this one, "A Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad." And the line comes from a verse of Robert Burns, and it gets truncated down to all sorts of like shorter versions. But this guy who's repressed, he's this professor, he goes off on holiday and he ends up finding in the story at a dig, he finds this whistle. Here he finds it on the beach. But I like that you have guys in suits walking the beach. You just know it's different. I aspire to be a guy in a suit, like, and go down to the beach, like poke around with my walking stick and like periwinkle. I want to be that guy. Like, I'll be happy. We're having this conversation, and I tell him, he's like, "What did you do to him?" Like, "I went to the beach in my suit." You'll know, like, I've made it. I'm happy. And he finds his whistle, and he blows on it. A little symbolism there. And he ends up being haunted by, it sounds like it's not scary, by his bedsheet. And it actually is really scary, because this guy's not just a non-believer, which is fine, but he's someone who has a closed-off mind, who's very repressed. And what's interesting about this short film, the amateur short film, is it's silent except for the soundtrack and some sound effects of like the wind.
The wind is, and that's, but that's so effective at the opening.
It is. You don't really need any more dialogue than that. Guy finds the whistle, goes to the pub. There's like the pouring of the beer, and he's like, "Hey," says to this guy, "it's sitting next to me, I found this whistle." They start talking about it, and back then, people didn't have to be experts, but this guy seemed to know a little something. And he's like, "Hey, you want to really kind of be careful with that. I heard some stuff." And he ends up getting bailed out in the end. But his life has changed. It's just such a fantastic take on this cautionary. M.R. James, he liked to have these cautionary tales to sort of like either be more curious, or in another story, like a warning to the curious, to check your curiosity and not go too far. So it's just this relic of cinema, and you will be a cool person if you know the story. You know the 1968 film with Michael Horton. We're actually later in the year going to discuss a Christmas Eve radio adaptation. Bit of a tease.
Love it.
Certainly this film that's only 10 minutes out of your life. So check it out.
It's awesome. Now we were going to talk Red Sox greatest of all time, but I don't know. I don't want to rush through that, because I think we'll have some fun. Can we wait and put that on the agenda for next week?
We should, because I think we will agree on number one. We'll differ on number two. And then after that, it'll just be like a free for all, smash them up in the parking lot.
I like that. I'm looking forward to that. I will hopefully have an appropriate acronym to describe it all when we get there.
Ah, Kimbolovich guy.
See you next week, Colin.
All right, see.
Colin Fleming, check out the Many Moments More blog. Subscribe to that. Visit the website, colinflemminglit.com.